The Golden Age of WBRU AM from 1946 through 1965.
Who listens to radio? That go where you go medium called radio. That's with you every night through the long commuter fight. And in the morning with your toast and mama lady-o. Who listens to radio?
I don't think that, you know, by today's standards of measurement, there was no such thing like WBRU was in my time.
Harvey Sindel, class of 51.
There's nothing comparable unless there's somebody broadcasting on their own out of a garage to the neighborhood somewhere without FCC license. There was no measure, there was no polling, there was no demographics to look at. It was self-satisfying and self-fulfilling. We had fun with it, even on the serious side. I mean, whether or not we were on the air at all was not the point. The point was what we thought we were doing as if we were on the air.
WBRU continued to broadcast exclusively through Carrier Current on the Brown and Pembroke campuses, available at 560 or 570 AM, depending on your location on campus, and how finicky the transmitter was acting.
Aside from music and campus news, William Eaves says one of the biggest draws at the time was the broadcasting of Brown sports games.
We did the first almost transcontinental broadcast of a Brown hockey game.
During the hockey season of 1950-51,
Richard Walton, class of 51.
Brown had one of the best hockey teams in the country, and they went to the national tournament. And we at BRU decided that, well, that's important, and we were going to cover it. So we sent our chief engineer, Barry Cohen, and the guy who did the normal play-by-play broadcast of the hockey games, Geordie Kaplan. We somehow raised a bit of money, threw a bunch of equipment in a car, and they drove out to Colorado. And there was so much interest in the Brown hockey team that one of the local radio stations picked up our broadcasts.
What Geordie didn't realize is when he went on the air with the first hockey game, he thought he was on the air with just the Brown and the Pembroke dormitories. But what the WDEN in turn sold it to the Yankee Network. And so when he went on the air, he was on the air to all of New England and eastern New York State.
So the entire state became aware that there was a college radio station. And that was, I think, one of the turning points in our history.
By the early 1950s, TV was king, and radio was becoming a different thing. WBRU's programming followed suit. Charles Hackett, class of 58.
That was the era in which Top 40 radio was just becoming popular. And it was the era in which radio was transitioning from something like television is now, where people actually gathered around the radio and listened to it at certain hours. And radio morphed into something that was really the constant companion, the background noise, something you had with you all the time. You could have it on at work, but mostly you had it on in your car. And niche radio began to be born. That is, if you're going to have it on as a background noise all the time, if you're going to have it on in the car, what you want is constant accessibility, reliable accessibility to what you want. So that if you're a classical music person, you want to be able to punch one button and get classical music. Well, most people weren't classical music people. But for the most part, what people wanted to listen to was popular music. The beginning of rock and roll.
The staff at WBRU started doing remote broadcasts at parties, and that was one of the first ways that rock and roll was slipped into WBRU's format. That was a big deal on an Ivy League campus at the time, since rock and roll was still considered something that teenagers and hoods listened to.
Dormitories, fraternities, organizations! Here's a surefire way to make your next party a hit. Have WBRU provide the entertainment. For one low price, you get music from Rhode Island's largest record library, plus WBRU DJs doing all the announcing. People like Roaring Jack Edmonds, Easy Ed Tuller, Dashing Dave Fears, all of Rhythm Section fame, as well as Rick Pike, host of the Wednesday Waxworks. Forget your problems of entertainment all evening. Let WBRU take care of it all.
Although rock and roll was at first only on the air during Saturday night dance parties, it soon made inroads into the regular daytime programming, particularly during the show's Rhythm Section in the afternoon and Eye Opener in the mornings, where I got my start.
Good morning, brown man. You're tuned to Eye Opener. Music, news, temperature, weather, and sports, all designed to get you up on the right side of bed.
Joseph Nardino was class of 64, and he remembers it this way.
We almost inexorably moved to the point where the whole idea, the whole concept was of playing rock and roll on our radio station. And it pretty quickly, during my administration, became almost impossible to fill that slot with somebody who didn't want to play rock and roll.
Don Harris, class of 65.
You have to remember, it was a transition time for music all over the country, really. When I was growing up, my mother went to symphony concerts, and my dad even listened to opera on Saturday afternoon radio. And they weren't highbrow by any means. They liked the pop standards, too. But rock was something different. There was really a generation gap at that time. Now, not my own parents, but I can remember some parents that called rock and roll the devil's music. They wanted to have it banned from the radio.
Do the devil dance.
Devil dance.
Do the devil dance.
See, we're talking early 1960s, right? And we're talking Brown University, Ivy League, and all that stuff. And most of the student body were too snooty to acknowledge that they really liked rock and roll music. We tried doing surveys of the student body regarding what kind of entertainment, what kind of music they would like. And they lied to us. Because they didn't want to admit that they really liked rock and roll music.
Ah, the heck they can't. Watch them go, Daddy. Do the devil dance. Do the devil dance.
As early as 1957, people like Charles Hackett, class of 58, remember the drive to have a real radio station, possibly on the FM dial. But Hackett says the university wouldn't support it.
They didn't want to put any money into it. And it was clear to them, as it should have been, that if there was an FM station, then the whole relationship was going to change. And the university's reaction was, we don't need the aggravation. But everybody knew that if the radio station was going to actually be serious and amount to something, it was eventually going to have to get off the radiators.
In the early 60s, there was quite a cast of successful WBRU alumni who had gone on to careers in radio and TV broadcasting. They included Walt Neiman of WQXR, Bob Lewis of WABC and many other stations, and Bill Littower of WPIX-TV in New York and WRC-TV in Washington, D.C. This legacy and WBRU's self-imposed standards of professionalism made them work even harder to get into a real radio station rather than a finicky carrier current signal.
There were always technical problems. Fortunately, we always had a few, I guess nowadays you'd call them geeks. We didn't have that term then.
Richard Walton.
There were people who'd be at 2 o'clock in the morning lying on their back under the board with a soldering iron or some damn thing.
One night in midwinter, we had a failure on the main power tube.
Bob Cope, class of 66.
So I went over and powered down the transmitter. 5 o'clock in the afternoon, maybe, and went out on a date. And around midnight, I took my date back to her room, and came back over to the building. And I thought, well, maybe by now it ought to be cool enough that I'll be able to pull it out. And I was still wearing heavy gloves because it was cold outside. And I pulled that tube out, and it, darn if it didn't melt my gloves right down to the skin. I got it out before it got down to my skin and had to let go of it immediately.
Aside from the technical limitations of the signal and the ongoing debates about programming, worries often stemmed from financial issues. John Meyer, class of 66, says students were in charge of raising their own revenues for the station, for better or for worse.
I mean, the university supported us a little bit, but when we wanted a new transmitter or we wanted new cartridge machines for the studios, those were on us. We had to earn the advertising revenue. So behind the scenes, that was always a big issue, too.
This is William Eaves again.
We had another event. I remember there was a born peddler. I mean, he was just a go-getter salesman. And he sold the broadcast of the home baseball games to the Narragansett Beer Company and as a sponsor. And the university did not take that too well.
Well, it's finally reading period, and now's the time to get out and enjoy that spring weather. You know, a great way to spend an afternoon is to walk down to the Beacon Record Shop, 821 North Main Street. Try not to buy anything the first time you visit this spacious store. Just browse around. You know, our guess is that once you've seen their large collection of recording music on tape and records, you'll want to buy something. And that's the time to notice and appreciate their deep-cut discount prices. That's the Beacon Record Shop, 821 North Main Street. Try it and see for yourself.
Despite occasional run-ins with the university, the largest amount of advising that WBRU received was from alumni and students who were working at other local Providence radio stations. They taught the Brew staff techniques for how things were done in real radio, and they also brought inspiration into the station for the potential of what Brew could be. I myself arrived at Brown in 1962, and I can remember one Sunday night in 1964 when 8 out of the 15 stations on the air in Providence were being manned by Brown students, current or former. I tell you, we were all hooked on it.
Somebody like Jim Mendes, for instance, who was an African-American DJ at WICE.
Charles Hackett.
His attitude and the attitude of most of the radio people in the commercial field were, hey guys, this is a lousy business. Why in the world would you want to get into it? But if you're interested in getting into it, I'm going to be very supportive of you.
They hired the students who worked with us.
John Meyer.
It was so important. Once we established that relationship, then I think we got to know the radio stations a little better. And in fact, we got some of their used equipment. One time I made a trip down into New York City, myself and Jerry Huboney. We went down to New York City and went to WABC and got a ton of used equipment they were going to throw out. But for our station, for WBRU, it was perfectly usable. I can still remember that road trip where we were just out of our minds laughing and having a great time and dumping 1,000 pounds of old radio equipment into the back of a van and then driving back up to Providence.
At 11:10, tune your radio to 560. Sit back, relax, light up a cigarette. Let your mind wander and you will have found the perfect way to end your day. WBRU's Nightcap. Each year at 560 on WBRU, Brown's complete radio service.
While WBRU had always been a significant part of station members' lives, by the early 1960s, there was a new drive and a reinvigorated sense of enthusiasm for radio at Brown. WBRU News, especially, had become an increasingly important segment of programming, and students took it very seriously.
News that shapes the world. Brought to you throughout the day on WBRU by NBC Newsmen.
Herbert Kaplow, NBC News, Washington.
Richard Harkness, NBC News, Washington.
And their nationwide correspondents.
This is Ron Nesson, NBC News at the White House.
Jay Barbary, NBC News, Cape Kennedy.
Plus 3 15-minute news summaries prepared in the WBRU newsrooms at 3:45, 7:45, and 10:45.
by WBRU's own newsman.
This is Dave Pierce reporting for WBRU News.
This is George Hyde for WBRU News.
To stay informed about what goes on in the world today, stay tuned to WBRU, Radio 56.
Here's Don Harris.
You wouldn't believe the way we had to get it on an old teletype machine that made a clickety-clickety typing sound, and we used to let that play on the air in the background behind a news or a sportscast. I guess we thought it gave the broadcast the sound of a busy newsroom.
To prepare for going FM, WBRU incorporated independently in 1962 because the university didn't want the liability of owning a broadcast license.
Stu Aronson was class of 1966.
You know, there was this ongoing debate. What are we here for? And I think that debate still goes on at the station. You know, is this a training ground for future broadcasters, or is it strictly an extracurricular activity? Is there more to it than just, you know, playing records?
WBRU is go for 18 hours a day. Here's...
John Meyer says that by 1963... station members, including Les Blatt, Mike Gradison, Peter Tannenwald, Jack Edmonston, Charles Sokoloff, and a bunch of others, were laying the groundwork for the purchase of an FM license.
They understood that it was more than just a bunch of, you know, college kids getting on the air and making stupid jokes and playing loud music. They understood radio as a medium for conveying things in a very professional way. And those guys are always the ones who are pushing for the professional side of things. You know, they wanted you to practice reading the news before you actually said it over the air. They wanted you to think about the music you're playing. But I think they are the ones who deserve the credit for seeing what it could be and basically pushing in those very early years, pushing toward something better.
Joe Nardino remembers the entire process as a rather secret, though ultimately successful, operation.
The general station membership was very carefully and intentionally kept out of that process. In spite of the fact that some of my friends were involved, I referred to it as a cabal. It was the people who figured they knew how to do it, and apparently they were right, because they did do it. But I think the general station membership should have been much more.
Although the station membership of WBRU-AM may have felt slightly out of touch with the politicking of the fight for an FM license, there was one population of staffers whose involvement with the station remained long limited, the Pembroke women.
Everybody loves my baby, but my baby don't care for no one but you. No one but WBRU.
Here's Joe Nardino.
We had a pretty good population of brokers among the station membership, although they were kind of pigeonholed also. The executive secretary was the woman's position. You know, that was a member of the board. But you very seldom saw them in any other role. They worked in sales. A few of them got on the air. In fact, we had one program reserved exclusively for them called Broker Break. But by and large, they settled into types, and they kind of accepted that too. You know, this is not exactly a revolutionary time we're talking about.
When I was doing it, which was in 59 and 60, around then.
Linda Letterman, class of 61.
There weren't women doing it, I don't think. And also, it was before we even were aware that we ought to think there was something wrong with that, if you know what I mean. I mean, today we'd know, gee, that only men did that. How come? You know, back then we might have said, well, men do that.
By 1965, the station finally got a big break when they found out local classical station WPFM on 95.5 FM was going out of business. But the university administration was unconvinced that FM radio was popular enough to be a worthy investment. So Les Blatt, class of 65, made a quite unscientific survey of cars on College Hill to see who had an FM radio. He said his methodology and sample size would have made his statistics teacher cringe, but when he wrote up his report, the university went for it. Maybe it was the promise to broadcast hockey games on the new FM station, which the dean of the college at the time felt was very important. Peter Tannenwald, class of 64, explains.
And they sold that station to us for $35,000, which was a huge price in those days. The $35,000 appears today on WBRU's balance sheet as donated capital, so I don't think it was paid back to the university. The university was definitely afraid of the liability for the broadcast content, and they told us, you make your own corporation and you make sure that we're not responsible for what you do. And so we did. Brown Broadcasting Service Incorporated was created and exists to this day as a nonprofit corporation with no owners and a board of directors made up of alumni and one university official, and as it was then and it still is today.
In a fitting twist of events, the last DJ to sign off classical station WPFM was John Leistritz, class of 65, who had been working there part-time right up to the end. Although it took until February 21st of 1966 to get the station up on the air as WBRU-FM, WBRU-AM alumni from the 1940s through 60s hardly treated the station as just a college station.
We all seem to have spent much, much more time there than we should have. We didn't go to Brown, we went to Brew, you know.
I would say that by and large, there was a shared understanding that we were in this, number one, to do it as well as we could, and number two, to have fun doing it.
I remember at one time I tried to be real cool and hip by lighting a cigarette on the air. You know, you get the scratchy sound of the match lighting and that first pleasant inhale of all that wonderful cigarette smoke. And I got a call from about four listeners saying, you are a complete jerk. You are out of your mind doing this stuff. Just play music. You know, and after the fourth or fifth call, that was the last time I tried that stunt.